Lawyer. There you are. Now I can see you both. I see you're both muted, which is inconvenient because I need help pronouncing the appellant's name. Is it Revasia? Revasia?
Your Honor, Revasia.
Revasia. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much. Case number 21-60029. We can see you both, and as long as you can hear us, could you give me a thumbs up if you could hear us? Perfect. Okay, we're ready to hear your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Darren DiGiacinto, and I am here on behalf of Deborah and Sajid Revasia, the appellants in this case. I would like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please. The reason we are here this morning, Your Honors, is the trial court abused its discretion back in 2019 when it elected to grant the U.S. trustee's motion to amend its adversary complaint, specifically because the trial court failed to identify the correct test or to apply it, such that we ended up with no finding of same conduct, transaction, or occurrence, which is the requirement under a relation back test, or to the extent the court did make certain findings and conclusions, those findings and conclusions were either illogical, implausible, or without support from inferences in the record. Ordinarily, as this court is fully aware under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 15, leave is freely given when justice so requires, unless one of the exceptions does apply. Here, that exception is found in the futility argument, specifically in that there is a time bar in place under the bankruptcy rules. It's in Bankruptcy Rule 4004A,
counsel,
which
counsel,
sets
counsel,
for
bank. Counsel,
yes, Your Honor.
We've read this very carefully. And my understanding, if I can cut to the chase, at least from my notes, I understand there wasn't a 4004 motion made. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And it seems to me that the 2016 tax refund was litigated and then the bankruptcy court didn't really make a finding, but it was litigated. Is that right?
It was litigated, Your Honor. There were three findings of fact entered by the trial court related to it. They all related to the fact that it was brought up and discussed without objection during trial,
yep.
That the U.S. trustee did move at the end of trial to amend his complaint to conform to that, and that although my clients did object to that, that they did acknowledge, as Judge Christian, you just mentioned, that it was litigated during trial. So the
so
only
counsel,
findings...
Again, we've read the findings. So if I could get to... If you could let me get to my question, I'd so appreciate it, because otherwise I'm afraid I'm taking a lot of your time. I have a pretty specific question about the 2016 tax refund. My understanding that was ultimately delivered to the bankruptcy estate, but I can't tell when. Is that right? Do I have that right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So then I'd like to go to your relation back argument, because I appreciate your point about futility. I understand what your argument is about whether this arises from the same transaction or occurrence, but it also seems to me that your briefing is devoid of the sort of the 800-pound gorilla or the elephant in the room or whatever analogy is correct, because the government has a really persuasive argument that the reason this amendment was late is that your clients failed to abide by their obligations to disclose. So I look back at the 2019 341 meeting. This was discussed. That was a year before trial. I think your clients indicated they recognized they should have updated their schedule. When they did update the Schedule 1 a month later, the wife's income stayed the same at zero. Husband's income actually dropped. I'm trying to figure out, when we look at this amendment, what we're really talking about is, was there unfair prejudice? Was there an opportunity to respond? I just don't see your brief grappling with that, and that's what's going to be helpful to me.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor, for clarifying that. What I would offer is one point of clarification, I believe, on what you said, is both of the 341 meetings in this case took place in 2017. In 2019,
hey, that doesn't help you, counsel. That doesn't help you, because that makes it even earlier before trial. But I've read the transcript where your clients testify that they recognized that this was a problem. So could you speak to that?
The transcript where my clients recognized it was a problem. I'm just not quite sure.
Should have been disclosed that it should have been disclosed that the wife's income actually wound up being much more than originally anticipated. It sure wasn't zero. That there was a failure to disclose.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor, on that. And again, without jumping into too many facts here, as I know the court has reviewed it. The question that was asked was the income at the time of filing. My client was unemployed. Whenever they amended the complaint in 2019, she had by then obtained employment. So by that point, she actually later in 2017 was able to get employed. That's why she went to Afghanistan and volunteered for Doctors Without Borders.
Right. We understand that. Counsel, we understand that. But I am looking now at ER 48 and just verified the second 341 meeting was on April 26, 2019. A month later, your clients amended their schedule. But even in that amended schedule, which I think is May of 2019, it's still a year before trial, and your clients Mrs. Dr. Ravazia's income is still listed at zero.
That is correct, because at the time they filed, that was what her income was. That's how she understood she was answering that question.
Wait a minute. As of May of 2019, her income was zero? That's just not square with the record.
I understand the court's point on that. That is well taken. The way that my clients testified here, and again, I have to get to trial to talk about some of these things because that's whenever they were fleshed out. We never should have gotten there is our argument, because initially in that 2019 hearing, when the court made its findings and allowed the amendment, at that point, nothing had changed about the circumstances in 2017 when my clients had filed for bankruptcy. They did not believe there was a need when they amended to go back and recorrect because it did not ask for prospective income at that point. This was something that was argued at the higher level, but I do understand how it can be confusing, Your Honor, certainly.
Well, let me just put it to you this way. If I decide from this record, if I am persuaded that there was additional income or a tax refund that should have been disclosed and that your clients acknowledge that should have been disclosed, could you map that on to the relation back doctrine for me? Because my point is that in this particular case, the government has a strong argument that the amendment was late because of your client's failure to comply.
Okay, the tax refund issue, Your Honor, was originally listed in the original petition. It was listed at that point as an unknown amount because they hadn't yet completed the taxes for that year. And they were subsequently able to complete the taxes. Those were available by 2019. The refund was available by that point. The refund was addressed in part in the initial settlement the Chapter 7 trustee had. And ultimately, upon discussing with counsel, our clients did provide that money back to the estate upon learning that the only thing that was exempted under the settlement agreement was related to any claim for exemption under the code. So I don't know that necessarily answered the court's question, because I see you're still... Is there a more direct way I can answer it for you, Your Honor?
I just wanted to be as direct as I could and tell you what the problem I've got with this case. And I think that I've made that really clear, but I've also monopolized the time. Judge Bybee, do you have questions?
I don't, counsel, other than the comment, this is not a flattering record for your clients. So I'm having a difficult time figuring out why the amendment back when the trustee had already pled a 727 problem with the oath, why additional evidence of falsity on the part of your clients comes as a surprise and should not relate back when the trustee could not have pled it at the time because he didn't have the information.
And to that, Your Honor, I would simply say that that is the difference between a legal nexus and a factual nexus. The amended claims that were added in 2019, the reason that it was targeted as a relation back argument is that there has to be a factual connection. In Re Gunn, the Ninth Circuit BAP, citing its own opinion in In Re Dean, made very clear, and it said specifically, in determining whether amended cause of action is to relate back, the emphasis is not on the legal theory of the action, but whether the specified conduct of the defendant upon which the plaintiff is relying to enforce his amended claims is identifiable with the original claim. And then it sets a two-part test. The first being, could you use the evidence that supports the amended claim to support the original claim? Or does it provide enough notice to put these debtors on notice that somebody's coming after them for these allegations? And in 2017, at the time of this hearing, the court, sua sponte, brought that up with the trustee. And there was a pending motion to extend time to object at the time, and the U.S. trustee asked the court not to rule on it, and then ultimately continued on. And when it came back, the claims simply did not involve the specified conduct of the defendant under the original claims. The fact that somebody may have made a false oath, when that false oath is identified in the original complaint as relating to the sale of a ski condo, potentially retaining an interest in it, having personal assets located in that ski condo, and making certain payments to creditors right before filing bankruptcy, has nothing to do with and is not related to whether or not Sajid and Deborah Ravazia, in reporting their prospective income, what they earned from their jobs, has nothing to do with that, nor does the allegations that they spent that money lavishly by taking trips to Europe or by paying for spa visits. And I agree with Your Honor that that the record paints a really negative picture of my clients, but that is not the standard of review that we are asking this court to apply here. We're asking it to apply the standard thank you, Your Honor. I'm sorry, I thought you spoke up.
No, but since I have an opportunity, I'm just going to observe that, so when you come back, I haven't heard an answer to my question about at what point does your client's failure to disclose come into this calculation. And what I'm hearing, you'll have an opportunity to respond when you come back, what I'm hearing you say is that it does not. So I'll give you a chance to respond to that.
Could you just say that a little louder? I couldn't hear it.
Sure. When you come back, I'll just tell you, I don't think you've answered my question, which is, does your client's failure to disclose come into this calculation on the relation back doctrine? I've said my view is that the government has a strong argument that the reason the amended complaint was late, and I think it's uncontested it was late, is because your clients failed to abide by their obligations. We're going to leave it at that now so that we can hear from opposing counsel, and then when you come back, you'll have 2 minutes. Actually, a little more than 2 minutes. Counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Andrew Beyer for Appley, United States Trustee Gregory Garvin. Your Honor is exactly right. The Ravazias are very unsympathetic debtors. The bankruptcy court denied their discharge for their material false oaths in their bankruptcy schedules and their sworn statements. Specifically, it found they overstated their income, underreported their income, by hundreds of thousands of dollars. It also significantly underreported their expenses. Now, those false oaths were material because that's the conduct prevented an accurate picture of their monthly disposable income. And that's important because, and those facts aren't challenged here, which challenges whether the amendment was proper.
So could I back up? So the amended complaint was filed in August of 2019, yes?
Correct.
I mean, accepted for filing. I think you actually lodged it earlier than that, significantly earlier than that, maybe June of 2019. Do you know that? I'm trying to figure out what the delta was between when the government knew and when they filed.
I don't know if it was accepted when it was ultimately ruled on or when we filed our amended complaint with the motion to amend.
So I just answered part of my own question. I think the motion to amend was filed June 4, 2019. I think it looks like it was accepted for filing because in August of that year, because the findings indicate August of that
yes,
year.
Yes, because the opposition and the reply and then the hearing on the motion to amend.
Right, so the second 341 meeting was in April of 2019?
That may have been a deposition.
And then we had the amended schedule.
I think there was only two 341 meetings.
Right, so the second one in April of 2019, and a month later, in May of 2019, the amended schedule. Is that right? And in June, on June 4th of 2019, the government amended or filed an amended complaint.
The 341 meeting, I believe, all occurred in both occurred in 2017. I think the transcript you're looking at is a deposition of Mrs.
Vazia. I'm looking at the findings, at the court's findings. Are you saying that the court's findings are incorrect on that point?
That wasn't a 341 meeting. The court may have said 341, but it was testimony of Ms. Vazia. Whether it was at a 341 meeting, that may have been misstated in the bankruptcy court's opinion.
That's exactly what happened then, because that is what he says.
Okay. So I do agree with the opposing counsel on that. The 341 was completed in 2017. It was continued. There was two instances of it. But I think the 2019 there may be a typo.
So for your benefit, for both of you, it's ER 48 that I'm looking at. On April 26, 2019, the debtors testified at a second 341 meeting. So it looks like maybe there's a typo in the judge's findings.
I think it was April 2017, yes.
Okay, so in that event, I'm not sure that helps anyway. That's even earlier, that the debtors are acknowledging that these disclosures should have been made. And getting back to notice and whether there was an opportunity to prepare for trial and whether this amendment was unfair. That's what I'm struggling with.
Yes, and obviously the government agrees with you. There was no prejudice here. There had been over a year of discovery, various delays and continuances. Some motions to compel were required by the government to get the information from the Ravazias. So during the course of that discovery, we discovered these additional facts that supported the false oath claims.
But wait a minute. If it's 2017 and there's a typo, so that it's really April of 2017 that they're acknowledging this, now you've got a problem to explain why the amended complaint was filed so much later.
Yeah, our argument is that it related back because of the additional discovery we did, delays.
But you're talking about relating back 2 years. Is that right? What discovery was done after the second 341 meeting? Maybe that would help me.
Additional records were provided by the Ravazias. The United States trustee took over the complaint from the Chapter 7 trustee. So
when did that happen?
That was in 2017. I don't know the exact date, but it was after the 341 meeting in April. Probably the summer of 2017. So these issues were discovered throughout that process. In addition, the income, the fact that they far underreported their income was a part of our further investigation. The fact that they had additional expenses, when we got the records from them that showed they had additional expenses that they didn't disclose on their schedules originally. All of those things led to our amended pleading, including the fact that you are correct that I think it was May 2019, the Ravazias amended their schedules, mm-hmm. which they knew by that point we were going to challenge their income statements. They amended their schedules to double down and essentially make the same misstatement about their income and expenses. Far underreporting it. And in fact, Mr. Ravazia reported less. By that point, Mr. Ravazia knew how much he had made in 2017 and 2018. By that point, Mrs. Ravazia knew she was able to find employment, yet she's still in that schedule, the amended schedule, they still reported zero for her income.
So the district court made a finding.
We could not have discovered.
The district court made a finding that wife, I'm going to use the, I know they're both Dr. Ravizia, that she had substantial income as early as May of 2017. I appreciate when they filed, she was looking for work, did some retraining and whatnot, but that substantial income, I think $260,000 in 2017. Is that right? Is that the right number?
Yes. Yes. And so it was through the discovery process that we got the records to confirm that income. And to confirm that she knew leading up to that at the 341 meeting that employment was likely to occur and she would likely be making income, substantial income.
So the trial was July of 2020.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a 3-day trial in 2020.
All right. So then can I get you to focus on my question? Because I think now we have the timeline straightened out. I think there is one typo, and that was very helpful to me to recognize. But it's still the best case scenario was that when the schedule was amended, this income still wasn't disclosed, and that's more than a year before trial. So I'm trying to figure out. The government has argued that the reason, I don't think you contest, this amendment was late. And your position, I think your strongest argument, is it was late because it was like pulling teeth to try to get this information. I understand that. I also understand that we have what we have by way of the authorities that opposing counsel has briefed so thoroughly about when amended complaints do and do not relate back, and we take that very seriously. So where do we bake in this fact that I've called the elephant in the room, that the reason the amendment was late is defendant's conduct?
Well, I think that these are additional facts that support the original complaint that would be allowed relevant at trial, and that's one of the sort of nexuses you can find when you're looking at a Rule 15C relation back issue. Is this the similar kind of evidence that would have supported the claims of the original complaint?
And
yes,
so you're going back to the transaction occurrence. You're going back to that vanilla test that we see over and over again. Does it arise from the same transaction or occurrence? So to that point, the way I read the original complaint before it was amended is a little different than opposing counsel. There's a general statement about the conduct of the defendants in failing to disclose, and then it says including, and then there's the itemized list, what I'll call the itemized list, about the ski condo
right.
and the collectibles and so forth. Yes?
Yes.
Okay, so the way he reads that is that the original, he can correct me if I'm wrong, but the way opposing counsel reads that is that that was a very specific allegation that really honed in on what I'm referring to as the itemized list, collectibles, ski condo, and whatnot. And the way I think you're reading it is that we should be looking at that broader statement before you get to the word including.
Correct. I mean, our reading is a little narrow on that. You couldn't put anything under that, although our argument is not that you can just state essentially they made false oaths and then not include any facts. But the facts that we did allege are related enough to the income and the expenses allegations that we later made. And that's because all of those things, the failure to disclose the ski condominium and the expenses related to that, all go into that bottom line number of disposable income, which they were trying to manipulate so that they could qualify for a Chapter 7 instead of potentially having their case converted to a Chapter 11, which would have required them to repay their debts and come up with a plan to repay their debts. So the conduct at issue was the manipulation of that disposable income number, which the condo expenses related to, the failure to disclose their credit cards and the pre-petition payments they had made on those credit cards related to those issues. Similarly, if you look at those issues, they must have had some income to pay for those undisclosed expenses, so that brings the income question into it. And all of that is that's our argument of why these are related enough that the similar evidence would have come in to prove those same allegations. But we also have the alternative argument that I think you're talking about is how can they get away with making false statements, false oaths, after the deadline is passed? And that's what rule four, that's what our rule 404B argument is related to. It's a separate issue. It doesn't have to, if it doesn't relate back, the rule 404B analysis says the court could have extended the deadline to reach that separate later fall of fraudulent conduct, and they could have filed a new complaint, or we could have filed a new complaint or amended to add that conduct. So that's an alternative argument that's how that conduct is captured.
And there was no 404 motion, right? There was no 404 motion.
There was no 404B motion. That is correct. The okay. The motion to amend we did file, however, set forth everything, all the requirements that would need to be established to grant a 404B motion.
Thank
you. It wasn't characterized as a 404B motion, but the arguments and the facts in that motion were enough to establish a 404B extension.
Thank you.
And then, unless you have any further questions, or
Judge Bea, anything further?
No, thank you.
Okay. We'll hear from opposing counsel. And because I wasn't clear, counsel, I just want to, it's ER 153 and 154 that I'm looking at, so you have an opportunity to respond. That's where the original complaint alleged that the debtors knowingly and fraudulently made material false statements, including, and the next is the allegations at 56. Knowingly and fraudulently made false oaths and accounts as alleged above, and that their discharge should be denied pursuant to.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I certainly appreciate the time being added. To directly the question you posed prior to the break, and then I'll go directly to what you've just brought up. You had asked about the failure to disclose. When does that come into play? Well, here, whenever our clients had filed their initial petition, they did so. There were two 341 meetings in 2017, shortly thereafter. And then there was the adversary complaint the Chapter 7 trustee had brought. And that was ultimately settled with the Chapter 7 trustee, but continued on. Nothing else happened in the case other than as they were able to complete their tax returns in 2019, they made the decision to file amended schedules. They believed they were assisting the court and helping to identify accurate numbers based on what they found from the tax returns. Obviously, Mr. Beyer and Mr. Perkins at trial took a very different position, and that was litigated out. But there was nobody had said anything or put anybody on notice that anybody was looking at anything related to income. Whenever they chose to amend, they did it because they then had a complete picture and were trying to respond to what was going on in front of them.
Okay, so I think it's helpful to understand answer. That the 341 meetings both happened in 2017. I appreciate that. But I don't see anybody, I mean, I've just verified the record as to when, unless you're going to tell me that that's a typo also, about when the amended schedule was filed, and it continued to list her income at zero.
Yes, and again, that was a position. They did continue to list it as zero because they believed it answered the question that was being asked in the petition specifically. And that petition did not say, what is as of the date of amendment, what is your income that you've made, or average it, or show us a prospective estimate of what you expect to get. It just simply wasn't in there.
Counsel, what's your response then to the question? Right, I think the trial court, I'm summarizing, that they acknowledged at the 341 that it should have been disclosed.
I'm standing here, Your Honor, without in front of me. I don't believe that is my recollection.
Fair enough. I will double check. I'll double check. I appreciate that. Go right ahead. You have about a half a minute to wrap up.
Okay, and thank you for that, Your Honor. And to the point that you brought up a moment ago about ER 152 and the statements that were made about alleging there were false oaths, including, and using that language in there that they listed, of course, including would tend to mean that that's a non-exhaustive list if somebody's looking at it. And so your point is well taken on that point. But if it is going to involve a CR 15 relate back exception test, we know what the standard is, and the standard is, does it relate back to it? And it is, we know from In Re Gunn in particular, that we are not looking at whether it is just a false oath. It has to be more than that, a false oath that based on the specified conduct of the defendant. All of the specified conduct added in the amended complaint is different from what was listed in the original complaint. And I would simply ask the court, or note for the court, the chart that was provided at ER 97 and 98 back when Mr. O'Rourke, who was trial was counsel at the time, had put that together to inform the court as to why it was objecting to the request to amend this complaint. And then I would, in closing, just finally point out that back in 2017, when the U.S. trustee took over, during the hearing that led to that, the specific discussion brought up this issue. And as I believe has been acknowledged by opposing, I don't want to misstate or put words in his mouth by any means, but whenever that was taken over, the trustee noted that it was with all assets and defects of what Mr. Munding had filed in that original complaint. That gave the debtors the ability to know that for moving forward with what the U.S. trustee took over, at least under this relation back 15 motion to amend type argument, they knew what would be in front of them. That was taken out from under them in 2019 and changed entirely at that point. And would simply argue that reversal is warranted, the proper findings were never made, and the trial court abused its discretion. Thank you for the extra time, Your Honor.
You're welcome. Thank you both for your very helpful argument. That'll conclude our arguments today, and we'll stand in recess.
Thank you.